This is music from the animated movie The Snowman. The film is based on a storybook of the same name that tells the tale of a snowman and his little friend and their adventures. We're about to meet someone who is no stranger to snowmen, and this music could well be his theme music, if he had any theme music, but the focus would be much too narrow, because this tune evokes just one snowman who takes shape on the page and on the screen in just one way, with one, even though charming, just one story. Bob Eckstein, on the other hand, brings us a bounty of snowballs become human in shape and spirit. He speculates, in fact, that snowmen are as ancient as the animal images in the caves at Lascaux, and he takes us back that far. He's written a book about snowmen, very likely the book about snowmen, and now he's known as the premier expert on snowmen. In his curiosity about such things, we find Bob Eckstein might resemble, in a way, a fictional character he admires. That's Sherlock Holmes, who, on the trail of the mysteries he pursues, is filled with a passion that would lead him at times to refrain from eating or sleeping for days on end, whose eyes would shine and cheeks would flush at the exhilarating prospect of doing his work, work which he loved, as we're reminded by David Baggett in The Philosophy of Sherlock Holmes. Baggett also suggests that discovery is seeing what everyone else saw and thinking what no one thought. And passion and a one-of-a-kind way of seeing the world are two things we'll learn about Bob Eckstein. Bob Eckstein is an award-winning illustrator, a writer, a New Yorker cartoonist whose work appears in the New York Times, the New York Daily News, the Wall Street Journal, Barron's, Mad Magazine, and many other publications, and that includes his cartoons, op-eds, short stories, and more. He is the author of The History of the Snowman, and most recently, Footnotes from the World's Greatest Bookstores, True Tales and Lost Moments from Book Buyers, Booksellers, and Book Lovers, a book celebrating independent bookstores that's been featured on the New York Times bestseller list. His short biographies say he was born in the Bronx and now lives in Manhattan, and that's accurate as far as it goes, but he also has a home here in northeastern Pennsylvania in Wayne County. And his choice to spend part of his life here tells us something more about his overall sensibility. We look again to Dave Baggett, who tells us Sherlock Holmes, in the story The Naval Treaty, holds up a moss rose and suggests that such things as our powers, our desires, our food are really necessary for our existence in the first instance. But this rose, says Holmes, is an extra. Its smell and its color are an embellishment of life, not a condition of it. It is only goodness which gives extras. And so, in exploring the origins of the snowman, traveling far and wide to discover what makes a magnificent bookstore, and giving time to help preserve Lake Lackawack and all the rest, Bob Eckstein uses his witty, quirky, and expansive talents in the service of the good things, and he sees the humor and irony in the basics of our existence. Bob Eckstein paid a visit to the WVIA studios to talk with us about his work and his wide-ranging interests, and we began by asking about his quest to learn about the ephemeral art of the snowman.
I do like history. I love art. And it combines those two things, if you see it that way. If you see it that snowman making is one of man's oldest forms of folk art. And that's how I saw it. And when I first started, I wanted to write a mystery book. I was given the chance of people approached me about doing something because I was a columnist for some publications. And I always thought, well, it would be great to do a mystery, but I don't want to do a negative mystery. I don't want to do crime. I want to do something that's more fun, like who told the first joke or who made the first sandwich. And I settled on who made the first snowman, something that had not been done before. And it also kind of filled a niche that I felt was missing, which is that it's a non-denominational holiday book. It's like really great to have something that's a new angle on the holidays. I did enjoy Christmas. I'm an altar boy. I was Catholic, but I still felt like there should be something for the holidays for everyone. And this was something that crossed over. and also had a rich history, which I didn't know at first. When I first started doing research, I was really pleasantly surprised. It was like finding a winning lottery ticket when I learned that it had this history going back to the Middle Ages. It was an early form of pornography, an early form of political commentary, and it was a really like charged subject back in the Dark Ages when people did have a chance to express themselves only when these opportunities came, like snow being dropped in front of their front door, free art supplies.
Who was writing about it? Was it the monks?
It's in journals. It's in some diaries. During my research, I collected experts around the world to help me with this project. And that included a professor, Herman Pleij, at the University of Amsterdam, who was an expert on Dutch cultural history. And it was through him I was able to go through these paths of finding, let's say, diaries and sort of little artifacts which pieced together this puzzle of when snowmen were first made. One of the things I did was, I traveled around the world and researched for 7 years, but the key moment was going to the Royal Library at The Hague, where I spent a few days and I scoured their image collection. They have the largest in the world, they had 8 million images. And what I did was I focused in on everything pre-15th century, and I actually literally sat there with magnifying glass going through all the old prints and engravings looking for evidence of snowman making. And what I found was sort of the holy grail of the history of the snowman, which is there's an illustration of a snowman in the margins of a 1380 illuminated manuscript and next to a solemn passage about the crucifixion of Christ. And it's an amazing story of why it's there, and it is evidence of snowman making dating back to that. It's the earliest documentation, although snowman making, I tried to prove, is earlier. This is the only hard evidence because it's in paper.
Now, we know big round bottom and then another round and then the head and the carrot and so on. What was that image like?
Well, this is similar to that, but I did learn that during that time, snowman making could be a fine art. I mean, great artists made snowmen, including Michelangelo, and they were commissioned to do so. And Larkin Mead, a famous American sculptor, also created a great famous snowman. That was actually, I believe it's 1859 New Year's Eve, where he created the snow angel. And so my point is that centuries ago, snowman making was not for children. It was something that adults made. It was considered a higher form of art. I'm also convinced that snowmen were made by cavemen. It's just that we don't see it because we all assume that cave paintings are the only art that they created. It's only because it's the most preserved. It's only because it's deep in these preservations and things made of stick and stones outside and mud and snow are long gone.
Now, you're a New York City guy, so what do you know about snowmen?
You know, I really don't know a lot about snow. I know a lot about art and history. I love going back and seeing why man did things. In the case of the snowman, it would be that snowmen were made because man always had this instinct to want to create images of themselves. They've always wanted to do that. And the other thing is to put one thing on top of another thing. There's actually old methods of pottery, which called snowman method, in which they used to take clay and used to stack it up the same way you would make a snowman. So this is something I've always had an interest in. I've had an interest in Sherlock Holmes. I wanted to do a mystery, but I didn't want to do something negative. I wanted to do something really, something joyous, something that people could really feel like they too played a part in. Because for all of us, I think that when we made a snowman sometime, whether it's as an adult or a kid, it might be the only, the first, and maybe the last time you would make a life-size scale of yourself or a sculpture. And that's kind of really neat. It's also very public, too. Where else do you make artwork that everyone can see and even judge?
For sure. And then there is that sense of theatricality where you have a couple of snow people and they're interacting and you can dress them up in costumes.
And the miracle of 1511 took place in Brussels. And it was like the Woodstock of the Middle Ages. And there was over 100 graphic scenes among the town that was a sexual of nature, also politically charged. And this was a chance for the people, again, to express themselves. And it was an amazing event and beautifully done, too. And this is all documented in old journals and things I discovered through researchers.
So you're going to go back to the subject now. And you've had a chance to see more snowmen and hear stories about snowmen. How else will you update the volume?
Well, there's a couple of things to update. Not a lot, but visually, I'm going to make it much more lush and punch up everything because I have a beautiful collection of snowman images and paintings that I've collected before the book and after the last book, which was in 2007. But in the last 10 years, I have some beautiful pieces of artwork. And it's just amazing. And one thing to update is that the world's record for the tallest snowman was broken. And that was in Bethel, Maine. So we need to report on that. That's something people want to know. Everybody likes to know there was a snowman that was 13 stories high and needed working permits. It took a month to make. I think the whole town like sort of had a hand in it.
See, again, there's that communal nature, the public nature of this art. Do you have any snowmen stories about northeastern Pennsylvania?
Not yet. But let's say this winter we try to make ourselves into the book. We have time. We all have to get together and put our shoulder to the wheel and come up with something. There is Wally the Snowman at Lake Wallenpopac Golf Tournament. They set up this wooden sort of target for their golf tournament. And if you hit this target, you get, I think, a free turkey or something. And I did hit it. I played in that tournament a couple of years ago. And the weather's been a little bit funky, so I'm not sure if there's going to be a tournament this year, but it's like one of the great things to do up in northeastern Pennsylvania.
Now, that brings us to geography. We've just been around the world with you. Now we want to come back to the Middle Atlantic states. New York City, Long Island, and northeastern Pennsylvania. Just situate your life in that triangle for us so that as we meet you.
Yeah, you just described my home. It's where I grew up in New York City. I have a place in northeastern Pennsylvania near the Lackawack Sanctuary where I'm very involved. And I'm very involved in land preservation. And I'm very conscious about the region. I love this region. I would love to see it do well. And then I also work in New York City. I work at the New York Times. I work at the New Yorker. And I do some writing for them and as well as doing cartoons and illustrations. I've been doing that for the last 10 years at the New Yorker where I've been doing cartoons. And I think I come to the country for material.
You could be out on Long Island. You could be up in Maine. What come
here? It's very beautiful here. I did go to a lot of different places to see where I wanted to find a place that's quiet away from the city. Having grown up in the South Bronx when I was really small, and then I moved out to Long Island when I was in junior high school and high school, I really welcomed the outdoors and stuff. And when I did finally move to Pennsylvania, it was just like amazing to say I had a tree. That was like such a thing. And of course, I made a snowman. But I found the place, quite honestly, by accident. I went to different towns and different areas. And I just, luck should have it, I found myself next to the Lackawack Sanctuary where I made some close friends and then became involved there. So it was all kind of fate. I mean, I think everything that happened to me is fate. Everything's an accident. And it just happens that way.
All right. Tell us about the buoys at Lake Lackawack. The illustration.
Oh, wow. Well, that's just something that is an educational sign. And Lackawack Sanctuary is part preservation, part educational, and part scientific research. And that just simply was a tool to use for visitors to come and understand some of the research taking place at that lake. That lake is a glacial lake. I think they consider it the most pristine lake this far south in the North American continent. And so for that reason, a lot of scientists in the community come to do their research there and use the historic lodge as a place, as a headquarters. And it's a great meeting place for that community. I mean, if you get a chance to visit the sanctuary, the Lackawack Sanctuary, you'll find these signs on the trails. And you'll see that I really liked what I was doing. I mean, I really enjoy it. In the same way, in my new book, it's something that you could see in the work that I really got into it, and that's what brings out my better work. I mean, sometimes I do things that, and when I started out my career, I used to always have to paint computers. I mean, there's all these computer magazines, and I didn't have the same passion and whatever. So I'm very lucky now that I'm starting to illustrate things that really move me.
I want to just take you back to the South Bronx. Were you in class making notes like the snowman in the margin of the illuminated manuscript when you were a little fellow?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, I was always interested in art. Like so many other kids, I would copy things like the Peanuts and Charlie Brown. And that's when I was really young, and I knew I had an interest that way. And then I found myself enjoying Sports Illustrated magazine. And again, I was just a little boy, learning about baseball and things like that. But my entrance into those interests was art. I really enjoyed seeing these illustrated and the colorfulness on the TV set, even watching these things on TV. So I suppose that's kind of triggered my first interest in art. And I eventually went to art school. I went to Pratt Institute at Brooklyn and went from there. But I've always also liked humor. I was always a comedy geek. And so I've always done some kind of writing on the side. And when I was in college, I tried to dabble in that. I couldn't get into the school paper, but somehow or another, I found myself working for Spy Magazine and for Newsday, New York Newsday. And shortly after that, I got work in Mad Magazine. So I don't know, I was lucky, and I'm really grateful for that.
What kind of humor does it take? What's a good cartoon from your point of view?
You know, well, there's no blueprint. Otherwise, we'd all be doing it, and I'd be able to do it every morning, because there's some days you wake up and you have no ideas, and you kind of wonder how you got that last idea. And there's no perfect way, but you do have sort of an antenna on that. You're always listening for someone to say something that can be twisted a certain way or came off as funny, and that you can use in a cartoon. It is something that you learn. You learn how to be better at trying to come up with ideas. An example would be that you surround yourself with people who make you laugh or who are funny. I mean, I've done that because I gravitated toward friends who would make me laugh. And I find myself, you know, on TV and movies and books. That's my thing. It's my wheelhouse. And what happens is that's kind of your classes. You kind of like learn from other people's way of being funny, and you do it yourself.
Describe how you sign your cartoons.
Oh, that would just be by accident. What happened is I think that after doing so many book events, the first book, and signing a lot of times, you just have a shorthand. And you kind of all of a sudden say, oh, I just made a face. You know, in my case, it makes a face. The B-O-B is the nose and the eyes. And then I have a little line on the bottom. And then it just grew from people saying, oh, I like that. And then, so, but again, everything's by accident, in the same way your voice or style. I think writing and the artwork comes about from just repetition and just seeing where you feel like most comfortable, where it just feels like, okay, that's now where I feel like it is my voice.
We were talking about how lovely the area is, and we know there are so many landscape artists, and they go out en plein air and they capture the landscape. When you were creating your bookstore book, did you actually go in front of a bookstore and do an en plein air sketch of the bookstore? How did you work?
I didn't. Sometimes I did. Every time I went to a bookstore, it was a little bit different. Sometimes it would just be to meet the people and find out their story, see if they were, you know, going to be in the book. Other times they supplied the reference. They gave me their favorite pictures. Other times I might take the photographs myself. Another time it might be that I did sketch at the location. You know, it depended. I mean, because I wanted each one to be different. There was no formula. Everything was sort of like, I'm going into this new experience, and the only criteria was, how do I make this store the most sexy I can make it? How do I make it romantic and feel like people are going to be drawn in to go to the store? So the depictions I have in the book are idealized. I mean, they're not going to be including every telephone wire and everything that happened. Instead, I try to make it feel like you want to go to this store. It's magical. And what else does the store have for me? And that's why I place the stories right on top of it in handwriting. I try to give the best stories of what took place in that store, what made it special.
And what was the impulse?
Well, no, in this case, I began doing a story for the New Yorker magazine on endangered bookstores. It could have been endangered pizzerias or something like that. It just so happens that was just simply an assignment and it went viral. By that afternoon, I was getting contacted by my agent for book deals to do something, and by Penguin Random House. So I embraced this new adventure. I really didn't know much about bookstores per se, but then I dove into the project really quickly. And then I met dozens and dozens of bookstore owners. And once I started understanding like the whole gravity of this business and the challenges, and I mean, there's a lot of problems. It's not an easy business. This is really a ruthless business because it's so competitive in this climate with online shopping and everything else. By the time I started doing about a third of the bookstores, the whole book started changing shape. It became simply not me collecting stories. It really was me thrown into this. I really started getting emotionally invested. I was coming home very inspired. Every time I was going to a store, I started really throwing myself into it. I mean, I would do some of the stores multiple times before I really captured the right mood I felt. Sometimes I got it right the first time. Sometimes I went back. Other times I had to pick what story I'm going to use. I mean, in each store, I had multiple choices of stories because I would talk to employees and the customers and the owners and all different avenues. Everything was open. I just wanted to have the best story. And so by the time the book finished, I was really wowed by the whole business and wowed by what's like to have a bookstore. And I even dabbled with the idea of owning a bookstore. And something I was thinking about, logistically, it's a little difficult with all the things I do, but definitely that's where I'm at. I mean, I started feeling like, wow, this bookstore thing now is really something. And I've been trying to write op-eds and do podcasts talking about the advantages of owning a bookstore, supporting your local bookstore, and not simply going to go online, because it's our local bookstores that are paying for our infrastructure. They pay our taxes. They pay the school taxes, the police. And these are people who are your neighbors. And it's more than just a bookstore. It's also a community hub for intellectual thinking. It's a place where people of like-minded people come. And for some people, that's where they get their start. I mean, poets and musicians. Some people go to open mics, and that's where they're going to get their start. And I want to take this opportunity to mention there's a local bookstore in Honesdale, one of the few in the area, called Loose Leaf Pages. And that's in Honesdale on Main Street. And I just want to say that's a great place to go to and support your local bookstore. You don't know what's going to happen when you meet people face to face. I mean, you can't become friends with a drone. You go to a bookstore, it is a place where you're reaching out and you're saying, you know, you're going out to see what's going on.
And we always talk about it in all kinds of arts where the form reflects the content. And this is a distinctive book in that when we think about picking up a book, we try to do it this way, but this is a different orientation.
Yeah, let me explain to the listeners that it opens like a garage door. The cover opens differently, and the whole format of the book is a little different from a traditional book. And that's because I wanted to make it feel like the tactile experience of my books, this book and the book before, was not something you could replace by an ebook or something you could see on the computer. I want people to pick up a physical book and get that special feeling we all had when we were kids, when you first had books, and books were something so special. And it's kind of lost now, I'm afraid.
And there are pockets, aren't there, where it's good. And then there are places where it's not good for...
Yeah, well, location, location, location. Different people are experiencing the highs and gaining, you know, some resurgence in their business. And they're expanding. And other places are being crushed by the competition.
You take us to India, Alaska, and Wales, but I love the fact that there are Pennsylvania bookstores, the Moravian bookstore.
That was the oldest bookstore in the world. And I think it's one of the oldest markets ever in the country. In other words, it's never mind bookstore. It's the oldest store in the United States. Everyone should go check it out when they get a chance. It started in 1745. There's people who argue this point, that there is older bookstores, but those bookstores actually were not really in continual business. They closed because of the war. There was one that was shut down from an earthquake, and then it reopened 10 years later. So this store is the one that could actually say it's the oldest bookstore in the world. It's right here in Pennsylvania.
And it's in our coverage area because we have a translator serving Bethlehem.
Oh, that's great. I have to go back there then.
Well, now I'm fascinated with something that you said right at the start, and that was you think you come out here to get some material. What inspires you when you're spending the half of your life that you do here?
Oh, that's a good question. It's a tough question too, because it could be anything. It could be happening when I close the door behind here and start going home, and I find myself in the supermarket. Like yesterday, I had an argument with the machine that does the self-counter. When you scan your own objects, then it tells you you're not bagging it right, and then you see that you're not getting the sales price. Well, it was really embarrassing. I had a meltdown, and I have to thank my wife for not like divorcing me last night, because I was slamming down this bottle of seltzer. I was chucking this TV dinner, the three cheese manicotti special they had. They weren't giving me the sale price. And I know they're trying to do their job there with the assistants and stuff, but I just lost it. And I learned later that people can understand and relate. It is a tough thing, but that could be the inspiration too for a New Yorker cartoon that happens next week. And that's where you just have to always be looking for something that's like a twist, something, you know. I actually posted this on Facebook and someone gave me a great punchline, which was that I said to myself that I give myself a 10 for the way I handled that crisis. And someone wrote back that 10 is the new one. It's a good line. That's almost a New Yorker line. I was inspired by a movie by Batman, by Tim Burton. Tim Burton came out with this movie, Batman, around, it was like 2001, when everyone was surprised to learn that he cast Michael Keaton in the lead. And everyone assumed it was going to be the campy TV show. And no one could believe that all of a sudden it was like this serious drama. It was like had all this impact. That was really something that turned around a lot of different ways of seeing things, like simple things. And then there was a friend of mine, Mark, wrote the book Salt. Another example, everyday object, household item, that all of a sudden became something that was fascinating, a story that had intrigue and everything.
What has making cartoons meant to you, and why is it important for us? Why do we love we do?
It's different for each person. You know, for me, it's a sort of thing with mortality that you want to leave something, your mark, that's like, you know what you do. I mean, if I had other skills, maybe I wouldn't be a cartoonist. What can I do? I'm doing what I only know what to do, and that is try to make maybe people laugh or entertain them in some way with a cartoon. And that's my way of making a mark. And then there's this sense of expression where, for instance, the last couple of weeks, I did the editorial cartoons for the New York Daily News. And I was given a nice forum to say what I wanted to in a whole half a page. And that's an opportunity that he doesn't come by every so often. I mean, millions of readers. I mean, there's like 2 million readers for that newspaper, you know, even though it's declining. But that's how many people see the New York Daily News, because it's online and it's everywhere else. And so what can I do in this climate? Well, that's the only thing I can do. Is the one thing I can do is I can add my little penny in the ante pot and say something. And I'm not going to take that lightly. I'm going to try to make the most of that opportunity. And that's what gets me up in the morning and say, well, what happened today? Let's put on the TV set and have a paper bag nearby to breathe into if I hyperventilate. And we're all still here, so we have to see the good side of things. I mean, there's so many parts of the world with trouble, so we are very lucky, too.
And I think that if it helps us see the things in just a little different way, whether it makes us laugh or think or both, that's good.
Well, I'm not going to pretend that I am making a difference with the message. I would say it's more to do with just the medicine that it makes you forget, makes another person forget, gets through it, because most of the time you're preaching to the choir, too. So I'm not going to pretend that I'm going to change legislation. But again, what else is there to do? I mean, you do what you can. And collectively, if everyone says something, then that becomes a movement.
Bob Eckstein, an award-winning illustrator, writer, and cartoonist who lives in Manhattan and also in Wayne County. His work appears in The New Yorker, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, and many other publications. He is the author of The History of the Snowman, issued by Simon & Schuster, and most recently Footnotes from the World's Greatest Bookstores, True Tales and Lost Moments from Book Buyers, Booksellers, and Book Lovers, a book celebrating independent bookstores that's been featured on the New York Times bestseller list. Terry Gross of Fresh Air has called the book brilliant. That book is issued by Clarkson Potter, a division of Penguin Random House. For more information about Bob Eckstein, his cartoons, his blogs, his illustrations, his writings, and his books, on his website, bobeckstein.com, and that's B-O-B, and then Eckstein is E-C-K-S-T-E-I-N, bobeckstein.com, The History of the Snowman, and most recently, Footnotes from the World's Greatest Bookstores, True Tales and Lost Moments from Book Buyers, Booksellers, and Book Lovers. And for more information on the web, bobeckstein.com.